The latest on the pandemic from Maine hospital leaders. One's perspective on the recent surge in the COVID-19 pandemic depends on where you spend your days. For those inside Maine's major hospital systems, it has been described as exhausting, overwhelming, and heartbreaking. For the past few weeks, hospitals have seen record numbers of people in their intensive care units, and although those numbers are ticking down a little, they remain shockingly high. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with leaders of Maine's two largest healthcare systems about the situation they face, as well as recent news about home COVID test kits, changing guidance on masking, and more. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible by Maine General Health, a comprehensive system for all your health care needs. Learn more at mainegeneral.org and by the Maine Souvenir Shop, committed to supporting Maine artists and designers. Exchange Street in Portland, Instagram at mainesouvenirshop.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is stunning to see how quickly the pandemic has overtaken our lives anew. Today, we'll talk with hospital leaders about how the healthcare system is handling the rapid surge and to answer questions about the Omicron variant, vaccines, masking, and other concerns. Joining me today, Dr. Dora Mills, who is Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health, and Dr. James Jarvis, Senior Physician Executive, System Incident Command with Northern Light Health. We invite you to share your comments and questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you again, both of you, for joining us. And I'll start by just asking what it looks like inside the hospital. Dr. Mills, what is the case at your inside your intensive care units and in the rest of the hospital? We see that the numbers are ticking down a little. Is it enough to make a difference?
No, it's not. They are extraordinarily high. So for instance, this morning at Maine Health Hospitals, we have 156 hospitalized this morning with COVID. This is actually really an undercount since we have a number of patients who are in the ICUs or on regular medical units who are recovering from COVID, but because they're no longer considered contagious, since they're about 10 or 20 days after the onset of symptoms, they no longer show up on the recorded numbers. But some of them are still on ventilators and or on oxygen and suffering from severe lung damage due to COVID or waiting for nursing home placements after is recovering from COVID. So we are extremely tight. And of course, the big difference with this Omicron surge is the fact that it is so highly contagious and has just enough immune evasion that a lot of staff are getting it. So we are, we already had a workforce shortage in healthcare before the pandemic. The pandemic has worsened that across the country. And then now with Omicron, so many of them are contracting it, albeit because they're all vaccinated and most of them are boosted. They're getting it fairly mildly, but enough that they have to be out for a few days. So our hospitals are busier. I would say they're overfull proportionally more than they've ever been, at least in over 100 years, and also understaffed, or staffing is very overstretched, I should say. So we are, really, it is challenging, a very, very, I'd say by far the most challenging time in this pandemic, and the most challenging time, I would say, in hospital healthcare since 1918.
Dr. Jarvis, what about for you? Is it the same thing at Northern Light?
Yeah, very similar circumstances. We have about 93 patients that are actively being treated for COVID across our institutions, with 55 of them being at Eastern Maine Medical Center. At Eastern Maine, there's 13 that are in the intensive care unit, and 7 of those are on ventilators. And then we have a few other intensive care patients scattered across our 9 acute access hospitals. Just like Dora said, you know, we're struggling with staffing issues, as they are, you know, our workers have to be out in the community as well. And so, unfortunately, we are seeing people that need to be out of work due to COVID-related reasons. But similarly to what MaineHealth has experienced, most of the individuals have mild symptoms, which is good, and be able to get them back to work so they can continue to take care of people. But it is concerning. We're also seeing more breakthrough cases than we had seen before. But again, most of them tend to have mild symptoms, and those that need hospitalization tend to stay less time in the hospital and don't require as much critical care, if any critical care, as we're seeing with those who have yet to choose to be vaccinated. So vaccines clearly are important, with that booster shot also being important because of that Omicron virus. The other thing that's causing us to do is either curtail services or close beds. And that's, you know, that means that those are not available for anybody else. Right now, there are 33 people in the service area that Northern Light Health covers that are at smaller hospitals looking for a bed for a higher level of care, meaning that they need either a certain procedure done, a certain kind of specialist, or intensive care, and they have no place for them to go right now. And that is alarming, that we have that many people that are waiting for a higher level of care that we cannot meet that demand for. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that we are overwhelmed with COVID cases, and we have staff outages because of COVID.
So those 33 people, Dr. Jarvis, who are waiting to be able to have a higher level of care, give us an example of what kind of procedure or what kind of care they might be waiting for that they are not able to get because the beds are being taken up by COVID patients.
Sure. So it could be somebody who has a severe case of pneumonia that's either on a ventilator or needs or looks like they may require a ventilator, so needs to be in a higher level of intensive care. It could be somebody who has had a cardiac event that's not emergent but still needs to have a cardiac procedure. And that is really concerning for us. You know, one of the things that Maine has always prided itself on is that Eastern Maine Medical Center and Maine Medical Center have always been open to be able to take those cardiac cases on. But right now, with beds full, it makes it extremely difficult for us to take those lower acuity but still so important cases to our hospitals.
Yeah. And Dr. Mills, you're nodding. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, we have exactly the same situation. Our rural hospitals have a number of patients who are waiting to get into a tertiary care center like Maine Medical Center or Eastern Maine Medical Center. And it's been very, very challenging for those patients, those families who know that if we didn't have the surge of COVID, that their patients would be transferred right away. We also have, you know, when you asked, I think at the beginning, like, what do the hospitals look like? Just to give you an idea, you know, every single space that could be appropriately used for patients is being used for patients. So we have, for instance, break rooms that used to be employee break rooms but years ago used to be a patient room have been reconverted to patient rooms. We have to also take care of patients sometimes in the hallways, in beds in the hallways, and especially in the ERs, where they get very overfull. We have patients who are in beds, are being taken care of, but you know, they're not in a regular room. They're not in an ER room or in a regular room being taken care of. They're being taken care of in the hallway. We have a number of behavioral health patients with an emotional or psychiatric crisis or overdoses, where we normally have some psychiatric ER rooms. I don't think they've had any room in those rooms for months and months. So we have a lot of behavioral health patients who are waiting in ERs to get into a psychiatric hospital or other type of care on the community that are also booked up. So we have a lot of those patients who are staying for days and weeks. And yes, we even have a couple of patients who've been for several months in the ER waiting, and normally either in an psychiatric room, it's a room without windows, without any other kind of equipment, or if they're out in the hallway, they've got somebody we've hired to sit with them to make sure they're safe. So that's kind of a picture of what it looks like right now. It's just people need to realize it is extremely crowded. Our care team members, however, are doing an amazing job. And I know that's true across all of our hospitals, including those at Northern Light Health and Central Maine Healthcare, Maine General, and our independent hospitals. The teamness that you've seen, the spirit of the team has been astounding. They are coming together. They want to be there for their patients, for the team members. I am always so struck when I go to, when I do rounds at the hospitals, how much the sense of teamwork that they have risen to this difficult, very most challenging occasion. So I do want to just tip my hat to our amazing frontline care team members who are there day in and day out and taking care of our patients.
And yeah, and I want to just add to that same sentiment, particularly for our smaller hospitals. You know, if it's a hospital that typically has an average daily census of only 5 patients, and they have 10 patients waiting in their emergency department for beds, that is, you know, 3 times the number of patients that they would normally be taking care of. They do a tremendous job, but it's not putting the right patient in the right place at the right time. And that's really what we're talking about, getting people to the place that they need to go for the care they deserve to get.
I just want to be very clear, because somebody might be hearing this, somebody might have just tuned in and hear us talking about psychiatric patients and thinking, what does this have to do with COVID-19? And what you're telling me, Dr. Mills, is that because we already had staffing shortages at hospitals, what has happened is that we're seeing more and more and more patients. At the same time, we're seeing staff who are out because they have gotten COVID-19, especially the Omicron variant being so contagious. So you're seeing even greater staffing shortages. At the same time, you're seeing more and more patients, and this is having a domino effect throughout the system.
It is. And with the psychiatric and other behavioral health issues, we've seen an increase, I think, indirectly because of the pandemic, or even directly, and this is across the country. The stressors, I think, related to the pandemic have precipitated or exacerbated people's underlying emotional health, mental health issues, addiction issues. And so for at least well over a year, year and a half, we've been seeing an increase in the numbers of patients and increase in acuity of people with behavioral health issues. And then on top of it, as you said, with the Omicron surge, we're seeing a lot of staff out. And a real tightness of the ability for community services to take care of these patients, as well as psychiatric hospitals like Spring Harbor and Acadia Hospital. They've been full. So we're having, particularly behavioral health patients, having to wait. Other patients do having to spend several days in the emergency room, but proportionally, it's a lot more of behavioral health patients who are just waiting for days and weeks, and yes, even 2 or 3 months waiting for services and a bed.
We've all read about one of the hospitals in Maine, St. Mary's, asking some employees who have been diagnosed with COVID-19 to work. Dr. Jarvis, are you having to do that at Northern Light Health?
We currently are not doing that for anybody who is active with COVID, but we do have what we call contingency staffing right now, where an individual who tests positive for COVID would come back sooner than we would have done previously in the pandemic, as long as they had a negative test result. And so we can bring people back as soon as 5 days after their positive test result in certain areas where we have staffing shortages and have that need. Whereas, you know, before we were waiting a full 10 days before we even talked about bringing people back to work. And so that's, you know, concerning. Again, it really has to do with the fact that before the pandemic, we had a nationwide shortage of healthcare workers, and it was certainly exacerbated by this pandemic. And now we're, you know, really in that place where we're doing things that would not be ordinary for us. At the same time, we still take every safety precaution. We make sure that both our patients and our staff are wearing the appropriate personal protective equipment to keep the spread as limited as possible. But again, with the highly infectious rate of Omicron, that's not a 100% guarantee for us. And so it is concerning that we have to bring staff back early.
Dr. Mills, is Maine Health also doing the contingency staffing?
Yes, we are. And I also just want to add to what Jim is saying, is that, you know, this we're doing it because we are so, you know, the demand with sick patients is so high that we are trying to balance all of these issues out and making sure that our patients are well taken care of. However, there are also a number of steps we are taking to ensure that there's safe and excellent care, as Jim has mentioned. So, and I just want to mention one of them, which is that nearly 100% of our frontline care team members are fully vaccinated, and many, if not most, are boosted. So that means with those high levels of vaccination, that's helping us. So even when our care team members do contract COVID, and especially the Omicron variant that they're contracting now, they are mostly experiencing a very mild and short duration illness, like mild cold symptoms, and sometimes, in fact, not infrequently, no symptoms at all. So bringing them back before that 10 days does seem a much safer than it was a couple months ago. And second of all, when they do return to work, they're wearing N95 masks, which are the most protective type of respirators masks. And we know that 100%, you know, of our care team members are wearing medical grade masks anyway, but those who are coming back after the diagnosis of COVID are coming back with those N95 masks. And also we have other comprehensive strategies to maintain safety. We test all patients on admission for COVID and several days thereafter. When a care team member does test positive, None of them are required to return to work while they're ill. No matter how many days after they've been diagnosed, care team members cannot return to work until they're feeling well enough to want to return to work and are without a fever for at least 24 hours. So that's, I think people just need to realize that there's a lot of other safety measures in place. And this return to work guidance, the US CDC guidance, is aligned, if not stricter, than other similar guidances, for instance, for first responders and teachers, where they can come back 5 days after they are after the symptoms and at least 24 hours of symptom free. Also, it's stricter than the longstanding guidance for other respiratory illnesses like influenza. You can come back from having influenza once you're 24 hours fever free. So, and then the UK and Denmark and other countries are having similar, adhering to similar guidances for return to work for healthcare workers as our contingency guidances are from US CDC. So this, it's pretty aligned, if not stricter, than what other settings are doing. And we have these other safety precautions in place.
An email here from Bill. There is much talk about what beds available at hospitals means. Are those actual physical beds available or lack of staff to cover those bills? Dr. Jarvis.
Yeah, it's actually a combination of both. So unfortunately, this week, Eastern Maine Medical Center did have to not have beds open because of staffing issues. And that's a problem in and of itself. But also, it's just simply the sheer volume of patients that we have. Most of the hospitals in Maine, are at 90% or higher of what their licensed capacity is, and sometimes even exceed their licensed capacity. And that is not an uncommon event. To put that in perspective, if you look at national averages, most hospitals are targeted to be about 85% of their licensed capacity. That allows them to surge up in the case of an emergency, but it allows there to be continued patient flow. And we're talking about having 90, 95%, or even 110% of our physical beds filled. Then that leaves no place for anybody else to go. So it's really a combination of both. It is a shortage in staff, so to staff a bed, but it's also just a sheer volume issue where we don't have any actual physical beds available.
We are going to take a quick break. We're talking with healthcare leaders on Maine Calling. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling. With help from Eastern Basements, a division of Maine-owned Eastern Mold Remediation, offering basement waterproofing solutions. EasternBasements.com.
Hey, you remember those steel tariffs? Well, President Biden lifted them on European Union steel a couple of months ago. British steelmakers, though? Yeah, they're still on the hook.
It's a few hundred tons of material that won't be made here in this foundry now. It'll be made at our sister company across in northern Spain.
I'm Kai Rizdal Steel over in the UK. Next time on Marketplace.
Join us for Marketplace today at 6:30. Maine Public is pleased to be a media sponsor of the Bangor Symphony Orchestra's Masterworks, Three Revolutionaries. Join conductor Lucas Richmond and the BSO on Sunday afternoon, January 30th, as they perform Mozart's Concerto for Bassoon with soloists Warren Saunders and more. Maine Public members are eligible for 15% off tickets to the concert. For complete details on the performance and the Maine Public member discount, please visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking with healthcare leaders today to answer questions about COVID-19, Maine hospitals, masking, and anything else that you are curious about in terms of the surge that we are right now experiencing. With me right now, Dr. James Jarvis, who is Senior Physician Executive System Incident Command with Northern Light Health, and Dr. Dora Mills, Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health. You can share your comments and questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org. Make it a brief email, please. talk@mainepublic.org. You can comment on our Facebook page or Twitter or Instagram, or give us a call the old-fashioned way, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. I'll go to Zafra, who's calling from Belfast. Hi, Zafra. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. And thank you, Dr. Mills and Dr. Jarvis, for all your work. And it's such a tough place to be, and I wish more people understand that. There was a vigorous discussion at the Belfast City Council meeting last night about even the idea of putting in a mask mandate. And unfortunately, it brought folks out of the woodworks to restate a lot of misinformation about the severity and impact of COVID in Maine. And I just wanted to ask if anybody has thought about doing a public awareness campaign in place of the please wear a mask signs that you see on all the stores everywhere that everyone ignores. Would it be possible to have local health professionals put their faces on signs and literally put a local face on the problem so that people understand exactly how bad it is? Because I don't think everybody in the state, unfortunately, is listening to Maine Calling today as much as I hope they would.
A great idea. Maybe we should do, yeah. I'll talk to our marketing communications people. It is astounding, the division that has emerged on this issue. Yet I know Portland just passed a mask mandate a week or two ago. And I went into the grocery store a few days ago here in Portland, and I thought, wow, it was quite eye-opening, because I was sort of used to seeing, maybe half the people not masked. And it was very reassuring to see everybody masked. And I thought, well, before I head up to camp, I think I'll do my grocery shopping here, because I know once I get up to camp in rural Maine that there won't be many people masked in the stores. But of course, the big focus has been on trying to get people vaccinated, but masking is the other, another major layer of protection as well. So.
I agree. I think unfortunately we do have, a lot of misinformation that gets out there, and a lot of it just really has to do with statistics. And I hear people say, oh, well, they're saying now that cloth masks don't work. Well, that's not what anybody's saying. What they're saying is they may not be as effective as a higher level procedural or surgical mask or an N95 mask, but they still are better than nothing at all. And I think that's the thing that people fail to realize, is that there is a gradation in protection. It's like, when we were kids, there were just seatbelts in cars. Then they came up with airbags, and now they actually have anti-braking devices set inside your car for anti-accident, for braking. All of those things add an added level in. And, when we talk about public health, one of the things that we focus in on is not staying stagnant with what we have learned and what we are doing, but trying to get better. Just like the automobile industry has tried to make cars safer and safer each and every year, we're doing the same thing. So when we come out with recommendations that say about masking, and that yes, it would be better if you had a procedural mask or you had an N95, that doesn't lessen the fact that a cloth mask still protects. And so I think it is important that we get that we continue to spread that message out, so we don't continue to spread this virus. Most people are contracting it by being out and about in their communities, doing the things that they have to do day in and day out, and masking is a clear-cut strategy to help limit that spread.
And I should just also mention too that I think the caller was mentioning having physicians do this. And, one thing I've been aware of, and Jim, I don't know how you feel too, but that I think the people who aren't masking or aren't getting vaccinated, they're no longer listening to people like Jim and me. So it's, you know, we really need people who look like somebody who may not want a mask or be vaccinated out there as spokespeople. I mean, we need people from, you know, the conservative churches or conservative political leaders, you know, business people in rural Maine. I mean, I'm just, you know, making these, you know, types of people up, but people who are, you know, people would think, oh, they're masking, therefore masking, or they got vaccinated, and yet, you know, I might not expect that they would, you know, versus somebody like Jim and me, everybody's like, oh yeah, of course they're gonna mask, and they're gonna say masking is good. So I just think we are in a different phase of, you know, of this pandemic and needing other spokespeople, my opinion anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing. I was recently just walking through a small town with numerous shops. Most of them had a sign up that said something about masks are recommended or something like that. But then there was one store that had a sign up that says masks are required to enter our business. And I can tell you the line for that store was longer than most of the other stores. And I think it was really important for people to see that a small business person was standing up not only to protect themselves, but to protect the other customers that would be coming in and out. So I agree with Dora that trying to get more people as that, quote, face would be really important.
Safra, thanks so much for your call. Dora, I want to ask you a question. Dr. Mills, I want to ask you a question about history and the lessons that we know from history. I know that you've studied the 1918 pandemic and were a student of that long before this pandemic hit. And we know a little bit about how that pandemic ended. And my understanding, and part of this I learned from you and part from others, is that virus began to mutate into a less and less virulent strain, and then it eventually petered out. Is that what's happening here with Omicron or not?
I can tell you in about a year or two. You know, there's this saying about all epidemics are lived backwards or something like that. I forgot what it is, but it's basically until it's in the rearview mirror, you really, you know, you don't have any 2020 vision on that. But yeah, that's a hope. Some of the experts I listen to are thinking maybe that's the case, that this is mutating in a more, you know, less virulent phase. And that is exactly what happened in 1918. It spread like a wildfire and was really deadly. Just to give you a context, so we've got about 1700 who've died in Maine right now due to this COVID pandemic, somewhere in that range, and I'm not getting it exactly. But so by contrast, the 10 months between the September of 1918 through the summer of 1919. Maine lost 5,000 people to the pandemic flu of 1918.
With a smaller population overall.
And I was just going to say we had 750,000 people or thereabouts versus 1.3 million now. So we had, you know, about 60% of the population, and yet we lost in a very short amount of time that many people. And they were mostly young adults, kids, so very different. And of course, many people might know that America lost more people in World War I due to the pandemic flu than we did on the battlefields. So anyway, due to war injuries and the like. So it did sweep through very quickly, and then it mutated to be milder. And of course, the H1N1 flu is actually includes a descendant of the 1918 flu, but also combined with some swine influenza. So it is, it did mutate to be less virulent and just circulated around and continues, the descendants of it continue to circulate to some degree. But we don't know whether it's going to happen with COVID. And the problem is, the challenge is that wherever it is circulating, widely replicating, it's going to continue to mutate. And we don't know. You cannot predict mutations. Is it going to mutate to be even more contagious and less virulent? Or more virulent? Generally speaking, people may be very fearful of, is it going to mutate to being more virulent and more contagious? Generally speaking, very vague rule of thumb, viruses that mutate, viruses want to continue to replicate, right? If they mutate to be extremely virulent and extremely contagious, they burn out. I mean, they kill their victims too quickly. So they tend not to do that, just because they may do it, but then they don't keep perpetuating, right? Because they kill their victims too quickly unless they form, you know, a way where they kill them, you know, with some delay. But anyway, so we really just don't know. And my concern, of course, is that, you know, the water on this fire is vaccine. And then the other layers of protection are, you know, masking and distancing and ventilation and testing. But the vaccine is the water. And we just don't have enough of that water around the globe. And so as the COVID virus continues to replicate at high rates in many areas of the globe, it's going to continue to mutate. We just don't know what the future brings, but we know how to get through surges now, and we just have to kind of go with the flow as we do with seasonal influenza and snowstorms. You know, we have our snowstorm routine, so we need to have our surge routines, same kind of thing.
We'll go to Cindy, who's calling from Saco. Hi, Cindy, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks. Yes, I just had a question for the doctors. If they happen to know if the children's dose of, let's say, Pfizer for the 5 to 11-year-olds would be effective for an adult. I know it's like 10 micrograms. And I'm asking because I was able to take the first dose last year, but then I had a pretty severe reaction and was advised not to take it again until maybe the boosters. But I would like to be able to take something. So I just thought maybe your guests might know of any research that's been done that for somebody that's, you know, sensitive to meds and things like that, that a children's dose might be effective.
Dr. Jarvis, do you know of any studies?
Yeah,
on that?
The issue there is really around the studies. So the initial studies very, very early on for both the Moderna and the Pfizer did include different doses for adults. The reason why they settled on the ones that they did was because that's the ones that they showed to be effective. And I'm not aware of anybody doing anything differently. In your unique case, obviously, I can't comment on that specifically. I do know that there are certain providers who have come up with different dosing schedules. I am not in favor of those. I think you just have to look at what your own risk stratification is and what the benefit would be from the vaccine and whether or not using mitigating medications to help limit severity of side effects from the vaccine may be proper. Dr. Mills may have a different approach to that, being pediatric trained than I am. I have not been recommending to my patients that they get split doses or anything like that, because we just don't have data to support doing it.
No, I agree, Jim. And I think I'm so sorry to the caller for what she's gone through. I would suggest there's also, you can take the other, one of the other two vaccines. So there's, you know, three of them. So if one of them gave you issues, you could take one of the other two as an option. And if the reactions are allergic in nature, I would go to a board certified allergist, because they have ways to help mitigate the allergic reactions, and also figure out what components you may be reacting to, you may be allergic to, and making sure that you get a vaccine without that component. And just real briefly, there is a, if you want to go to the healthcare website that we, Jim and I and others look at a lot, if you Google US CDC clinical considerations COVID-19 vaccinations, in some combination of those words will get you to it, but it's US CDC COVID vaccinations clinical considerations. It has a plethora of information about the vaccines and what kind of reactions you might have had and what kind of options that you have. It is written for clinicians, so it's in medical speak, but I think a lot of people can read through it and figure out what the options are.
Cindy, thank you for your call and good luck to you. Let's see, we have a couple emails here that are kind of related. We'll start with this one from TH. I have a question about getting emergency treatment for something like cardiac event, car accident, stroke, or other type of emergency that's going to require a team to be able to do emergency treatment for that injury or that condition. Can you tell me whether or not that's going to be something that will have staffing to be able to provide that care? This is a very real concern among a lot of people I speak with.
Yeah, that's a concern for us as well. And it's really kind of the reason why for 2 years now, Dr. Mills and I have been kind of pleading our case about trying to do all the things you can limit spread. And then, of course, for the last year to really encourage vaccination. You know, the fewer people who get sick, the fewer they have to access our hospitals, keeping beds open, keeping staff available, keeping those key teams that you just described available to take care of the other things. You know, we talk about things that you just described, you know, cardiac events, car accidents, but what about happy events? Being able to deliver a baby safely in a safe setting in a hospital. While we have been fortunate in Maine that we have not had to limit that to any certain degree, there are other places in the hospital where they've shut down their maternity wards because they need those beds for patients who are sick with other conditions. That means that a woman might need to travel further or unfortunately deliver in an unsafe location. So it's more than just looking at those acute things. And so again, it's our plea to the public. You are not just helping yourself, you're helping everybody around you. When you get vaccinated, when you wear your mask, when you stay home when you're ill, and when you wash your hands frequently, doing those things that we've talked about over and over again helps to keep beds available so that if you or someone you love has a heart attack or a car accident or wants to deliver their baby in a safe location, they can do so because there's a bed available in Maine. We have always been short on having beds available in Maine. This has just made that crisis even worse.
In a related email from John, it sounds like the care of unvaccinated COVID patients is potentially compromising the care of vaccinated patients with other diseases. Why shouldn't we deprioritize the care of unvaccinated COVID patients versus the care of patients with other diseases? Dr. Mills, a question, a similar question comes in every time we do a Maine Calling with medical professionals. What is your answer to John?
You know, we took a Hippocratic oath years ago, Jim and I did, when we went into medicine. And I think all of us adhere to the fact that we are here to treat whomever comes through our doors. And we will do the best we can to treat everybody with the best treatment we have, as they come through our doors. And that is, you could take that kind of logic even much farther and just say, somebody smoked a lot for many years and they've got lung cancer. Do we prioritize them? Do we, they're very obese and they've got heart disease as a result. I mean, there's a lot of, when you start using that kind of logic, unfortunately, it does pretend like we are all in control, completely in control of our own health. And yes, we have a lot of personal responsibility for our own health, but our own health is also very much influenced by by the context in which we live, our zip code where we live, the information and the misinformation that we are subject to. So the marketing by the tobacco industry, for instance. So there's a lot that we don't have choices in. And so that's why we took the Hippocratic Oath, because we do believe in treating everybody who comes through our doors.
Yeah, and it also puts our healthcare workers in that very difficult situation, trying to decide, well, which unvaccinated person is the one that's at fault for whatever. We know that there are people who can't be vaccinated for medical reasons, and therefore they should not be told they can't get treatment for COVID simply because they had a medical reason why they couldn't get vaccinated. So it becomes a very, very difficult area. And as Dora said, we are trained to take care of people. We prioritize by taking care of the people that are the sickest, that are in need the most, that we can help the most. And that's really what our prioritization should be and continues to be to this day.
We're going to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Bread and Butter Catering Company, committed to creating bountiful feasts and custom drinks, showcasing their love for Maine. BreadandButterCompany.com.
I'm Scott Tong. The HBO documentary Simple as Water is on the shortlist for an Oscar nomination. The film looks at the effects of the Syrian war on four families spread across five countries.
Each family in the film has some unspeakable loss, yet they also have this intense determination.
Next time on Here and Now.
Join us for Here and Now today at noon.
Some people say it's a state of mind. Others insist there's no such thing. But others pack their bags, say their goodbyes, and head out of the door. On the next Snap Judgment, we're going with them to Shangri-La. Come with. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Wednesday evenings at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today on the show, we are talking with healthcare leaders in Maine. Joining me, Dr. Dora Mills with Maine Health and Dr. Jim Jarvis with Northern Light Health. We are, of course, talking about the pandemic. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to talk just a little bit about the COVID test that will be shipped through the mail. Brand new news this week. People have already been signing up. An email here from Julie. With so many at-home rapid COVID tests being shipped through the mail, won't a large number of them be exposed to temperatures outside the ranges at which they are supposed to be stored, particularly at the colder end? What would that do to the reliability of the test? Dr. Jarvis, are you worried about these tests?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really am not. So the tests that will be offered from the federal government are reliable tests, ones that we ourselves are using. And so I don't think that should be an overwhelming concern. Certainly everybody should be able to at least read what the package insert says on there to see if there was anything unusual, you know, if the package got wet or something along those lines. But for the most part, they should be, the transportation for them, you know, even through the Postal Service should be adequate. So I don't really have any concern, you know, particularly about that. I do have concern about people just going on the web and purchasing at-home tests from unreliable sources. We have certainly seen that, unfortunately, there are those who will try to make money off of any kind of crisis. And unfortunately, there are some untested tests that can't be reliable, and it just causes more either people thinking that they're negative when they're really positive, or getting a positive test and then needing to have a retest done by some other location. One of the reasons why we're happy about having these home tests now becoming available, hopefully by the end of this month and into February, will be that it will actually limit the amount of tests that we have to do as healthcare agencies. Unfortunately, we are experiencing record numbers of people requiring tests, both for clinical reasons so that they can get healthcare, or because they have symptoms and they want to make sure they keep their families and their communities safe. And that's resulting in delays in us getting test results back, and it's also resulting in long lines at testing centers. And so at-home tests can help that dramatically. They are certainly very accurate when we're talking about people who are symptomatic, but even people who are asymptomatic who have had a significant exposure, they can be somewhat of a comfort to know if you have a negative test in that regard.
All right. And how does one get one of these tests?
Yeah, so the way that you can get it through the government is to go to their new website. It just launched yesterday, a full day early, so that's amazing for the federal government. And it's COVIDtests, that's a positive S at the end, .gov. So COVIDtests.gov. When you go there, it's a very simple process. It takes about 2 minutes, if that, to go in and fill in all your information. And the Postal Service, once they get those in stock, will be happy to ship them to you.
All right. Christina on Facebook asked, for rapid home antigen tests, I've heard that throat swabs may yield more accurate results than nose swabs. Is this the case? If so, what's the best source of instructions on throat swabs? The tests I've seen contain instructions for nose swabs only. Dr. Mills, have you given yourself one of these tests, and how do you do it, nose or throat?
Yeah, well, I think the jury is out on that. You know, the information is flowing so quickly that it's hard, I know, for Jim and me even to keep on top of it. But yes, I mean, there is some emerging evidence that perhaps Omicron variant does stay in your throat more. We're getting a lot more reports of sore throats. But, you know, when you do swab your throat, though, you have to be careful that you're swabbing the right part of your throat. It's a kind of the sides of the opening in the way in the back, and you don't want to touch your tongue. So that's a lot to do. And then you should really, you know, swab your nose, not to get too gross, but it's, you know, you want to do both. So probably the back of your throat and then your nose. But then others are saying, you know, these swabs were not meant for throats. So we don't really know whether it increases the sensitivity or not. I've heard some anecdotes of people whom I know said that, hey, you know, I swabbed my nose, got a negative, swabbed my throat and then my nose, and I got a positive. But, you know, who knows? But if you want to try it, sure, there's probably not any harm in it, but just don't, I wouldn't, just be careful not to touch your tongue because that can negate it a little bit. So,
oh boy. We'll go to Libris calling from Augusta. Hi, Libris, go ahead.
Good morning. I see the crucial problem with public cooperation to do what is proper being with the explanation we're currently using and the terminology. And the problem is that contrary to the anti-vaxxers and the anti-maskers, there's no foreign molecules being inserted into our body system using the vaccine, which is what they're claiming. And the problem is they don't understand and they're not being informed that the messenger RNA, which is complementary to the RNA in our cells and complements the DNA in our cells, is what starts everything coming through the vaccine, so that it alerts the RNA in our body to contact the T cell production, which produces the antibodies, and the antibodies then seek out the foreign things that are attacking our DNA, and so it locates the virus, and it gangs up on the virus to prevent it from replicating in the DNA, and it also ejects it from the cells of the body, and this is excreted through our excrement.
So Liberace, what you're saying is you think that the explanation that's been being given by the medical establishment about how it works, if the explanation were better and people better understood the vaccine and how it worked, more people would be willing to get it.
Well, actually, I think they're giving misinformation by the way that they're presenting it, because it's the elimination from the body into the waste treatment plant where the virus is actually killed. And the waste treatment plant is responsible for eliminating the polio virus, the diphtheria virus, and it's crucial that people understand that that's the process. It's removing the virus and treating it in the other way. Now, the other problem
Liberace, we're tight on time. I need to let our doctors respond. Dr. Jarvis.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I wasn't quite able to follow the whole discussion there. But, you know, again, the three vaccines authorized here in the United States, one that has full approval, they are safe, and their mechanism of action is well documented. The two messenger RNA vaccines insert code that codes for the spike protein. It makes your cells make the spike protein. That turns your immune system on to the spike protein. As the caller did say, what gets injected is actually degraded very, very rapidly. Messenger RNA does not stay around in our body. And again, messenger RNA is something that our own bodies produce all the time. The Johnson & Johnson is actually just one step before that. It uses the viral vector to bring in the some of the coded information to create the messenger RNA. And so they actually work in very similar methods. None of them cause any long-term or lasting harm. We've now been using these from the people that were in the original studies. Has almost been 2 years since they were in the original studies. Many of us, like particularly in healthcare worker, are now well over a year since we've gotten our first sets of vaccines, and we just see no long-term effects. And again, with vaccines, long-term effects typically occur within 8 weeks of administration of the vaccine. Again, many of us are now well over 12 months from our first shot, and so we feel very comfortable and very safe with those.
All right, Liberace, thanks for your call. Going to try to squeeze in a couple more, going to Pam in Gorham. Hi, Pam. If you could be quick, that would be great. Thank you.
I will be. So this is my question. My husband and I are disagreeing. We both have been vaccinated and boosted. And since Thanksgiving, the surge in Thanksgiving, at Thanksgiving time, and then Christmas, my husband is refusing to go to any public place like a restaurant, a concert, any place like that. And I'm saying, well, that's why we got shots and boosted, so we can do these things, you know, wearing a mask, except when we're eating.
Sure. I have a feeling you're not the only couple having this argument. And Dr. Yeah. Jarvis, I have a feeling you're not going to settle it, are you?
No, I don't think I am. I think, you know, again, each of us has to make those decisions for ourselves. You are correct. The reason why we got vaccinated and to get boosted was to protect ourselves and protect those that are around us. I think, you know, we do know that particularly with the highly infectious variant called Omicron, that added protections beyond those vaccinations are necessary because we are seeing breakthrough cases. I think it becomes up to individuals. I will say personally, I have felt comfortable going into gatherings. I do wear my face covering whenever I am indoors. I often wear two masks at a time. I did recently travel with my family. I will tell you, we had the discussion about eating indoors or outdoors, or that. We elected to mostly eat outdoors, and that just, again, for our own comfort level. But each person's going to have to individually decide that. I think if you're taking all the protections you can, you know, that's the way that we get back to normalcy. And again, each person's going to have to make that decision for themselves.
And Dr. Jarvis, I understand you need to dodge out a little bit early, so thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Jim Jarvis, Senior Physician Executive, System Incident Command with Northern Light Health. Thank you so much for being with us, and we're going to squeeze
in. Thank you,
Jen.
It's always a pleasure, and I always love to commiserate with Dr. Mills, so thank you very much for the opportunity. Everybody
thanks
have a
so
great
much.
Day. Stay safe.
Thank you, and we're going to try to squeeze in at least one more call for Dr. Mills. Marion and Cape Elizabeth, go ahead.
Yes, just a quick question for the experts about how often masks should be changed. It's really interesting. We haven't heard much advice on that. So I canvassed my coworkers here. There are about 11 of them. Not one gave the same answer. Some people wore cloth. They wash it with their laundry once a week. Some people just left theirs in their car, and when they went into the grocery store, they put it on. When they left, they put it back in the car and use it over a month. So I know there's droplet and airborne transmission.
Yeah, Marion, I think that's a great question. Yeah, and I share that question. Dr. Mills, if somebody keeps an N95 mask in their car in Maine in the winter, really, what are the chances that a virus is going to survive on that mask in between trips to the grocery store?
Very low. So it really depends on the type of mask and how soiled it is. So, you know, a fabric mask is not as effective as a procedure surgical mask, a medical grade mask, or an N95, right? So that's your progression. And a fabric mask, one of the reasons it's not that effective is that it does tend to get porous. The viruses get into it much more easily. When it gets moist, it gets soiled, whatever. So a fabric mask, when I was wearing those at the very beginning of the pandemic, I was washing them like underwear. You know, you wear them once and then you wash them. The surgical mask, a procedural mask, a medical kind of mask, you can wear them, you know, especially if you just wore them to go into the store and back. I keep them in my car and wear them several times. But once it gets soiled, for me, the test is it's got my lipstick all over it. Then I kind of know it's time to throw it away. And then N95s are thicker. So I do now wear more N95s, especially if I'm going to go anywhere indoors that's crowded, like the grocery store. And those I can wear several times because you can tell they're very thick, and they don't get so soiled or, you know, as easily. So it depends on what type of mask you are. But once you can see that it's getting a bit porous because it's soiled, it's gotten wet, especially with your breath, if you've been in a, you know, heavily breathing and running with it or something, then you want to, you know, it's time for a new mask or to wash it up with a fabric mask.
Marion, thanks so much for a question. I know so many people share. And Dr. Mills, we have about a minute left, and I know you wanted to address the issue of people talking about Omicron as being so much milder than the Delta variant and the original variant of COVID-19. So go ahead and address that.
Yeah. You know, so the good news it is for people who are boosted, who fully vaccinated, in particular, they're boosted, it does tend to be much, much milder. But, you know, it is so much more contagious that we are seeing so many more people with it, and including in our ICUs. So, for instance, our statewide, the numbers of people with COVID in our intensive care units and or on ventilators is about twice as many as it was a year ago, which was the prior worst surge that we had. So, you know, yes, it's milder, particularly if you've got, you know, if you're healthy and young and you've fully boosted and all that. But boy, there are a lot of people still getting extremely ill with it. So, but the good news is, you know, it is the dark of winter. It's the coldest time of year. We're in a very serious surge. But you know what? It's going to get better. So the spring is going to get lighter. It's going to get warmer. And just like spring's going to come, this surge also will simmer down. It may be another 3 or 4 weeks or so, but it will simmer down. So hang on, make sure you're taking all those layers of protection you can, vaccination, masking, distancing, ventilation, and testing. But hang on and it'll get better. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Dora Mills, Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health. Today's sound engineer, KG Akimoladun. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we find out how Maine schools are dealing with this surge in COVID cases among students and staff. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.